This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Fahad Hashmi's father. Fahad has been imprisoned and kept under special administrative measures on charges of providing material support to Al-Qaeda. His crime? Storing rain gear in the closet of his London flat.
It's another hogwash case like the case against Lynn Stewart, concocted by the government to scare the pants off of people saying that they're Muslim terrorists.
We'll also hear a talk from our own Michael Ratner at the Left Forum on a panel titled Torture and the Decline of the American Empire.
A lot of energy at the Left Forum. 2,300 people came. Michael's room was packed, standing room only. There's a lot of expectations that things are happening.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. I wanted to share with the listeners, Heidi and Michael, some thoughts on this, the fifth anniversary of the War of Iraq. Of course, as Michael's pointed out, in terms of international law, it's the supreme crime, the crime of aggression. And the interesting thing is that it's come out. I watched Taxi for the Dark Side, that movie about torture. The guy that was tortured and linked Al-Qaeda with Iraq, which is what the Bushes were trying to get, that link was what Colin Powell broadcast at his speech at the UN, which served to justify the war of aggression.
And of course, so, he was tortured, that guy.
Yeah.
I think it was Ali was his name. And they later, even the CIA said everything he said was false about the so-called link with Al-Qaeda and Iraq.
So much for any pretense that Iraq was a danger. There's that song, Operation Iraqi Liberation. That's what they originally called the war of aggression. Until they realized that Operation Iraqi Liberation stood for OIL, oil. And then they had to change the name to Operation Iraqi Freedom. But freedom, Lancet, the British journal, said about a million people have, civilians have been killed so far. That's not to speak of the 650 children who were killed just under the sanctions that Clinton put on them. 29 million people don't even have clean drinking water. I mean, they've destroyed that country. They burned down the libraries, this cradle of civilization. And you watch the Winter Soldier hearings on TV. Amy Goodman's been featuring it. And it's just this endless young American soldier after another coming up and admitting to the war crimes that he himself committed.
Now, Michael, you were present at the first Winter Soldier. And of course, we know what the origin of the term is. It's from the pamphlet by Tom Paine, Common Sense, about summer soldiers and winter soldiers and those who really continue to care and fight on, really, in the Revolutionary War, I think. Isn't that right?
That's precisely right.
That's the origin.
The ones who stayed in camp over that bitter winter.
You were at the first, and how do you look at—
When was that first one?
It was in 1971. I was practicing military law, actually, in Detroit. I'd been out of law school 4 years, and I was very active in the anti-war movement. The niche that I kind of fell into was supporting anti-war GIs on various bases around the country. Then the Winter Soldier investigation came to Detroit. It was the Vietnam Vets Against the War. And of all places, they picked Detroit. I guess it's because it was a very radical city at the time. They had the first Winter Soldier expose of American war crimes in Vietnam right there in Detroit, right under my nose. So I went and I covered it for the Militant newspaper. I sat there, and it was just so reminiscent when I watched the Iraqi Winter Soldier investigation of what I heard years ago. I mean, the bottom line is that they turned these Americans into monsters. You know, you heard Seymour Hersh talking about shooting kids in a ditch in My Lai. which incidentally is the 40th anniversary of my lie. They're doing the same thing to these American kids that they got stuck over there. They're so fearful and deranged, and the Iraqis are so dehumanized as Muslims that they can just kill them like game in a field.
I mean, my lie is important for a lot of reasons. One, because while it was the exception, and the claim was that there was an exception and that there were especially bad apples, it's just like today in Iraq, where every killing that they actually have a witness for is an exception, or every torture and not the routine. But of course, my lie was part of Operation Phoenix, which was a nationwide Vietnam torture and killing program run by the CIA.
Yeah, yeah. Make that connection. And the other connection is, where did the CIA learn the torture techniques in Operation Phoenix? They learned it from the French, who tortured people in Algeria.
That's right. So here we are, entering the sixth year of the war in Iraq. No clear statement by any candidate of withdrawal right now. We should understand that. You know, in my own mind, of course, any person who voted for this war, and particularly someone like Hillary Clinton, I could never, ever see. It was one of the more, as voting for her, it's one of the more cynical, opportunistic votes I've ever seen in my life, when all of us probably who listened to this show knew that war was bad from the beginning. But none of the candidates are really talking about immediate withdrawal right now. Even Barack Obama is saying we have to talk about how we're going to get out. They say they want to get out, but none of them are really giving us a plan for getting out.
Part of the reason the economy is falling apart is that they've borrowed $3 trillion to fight the war. They borrowed it from the Chinese and from the Japanese. That puts downward pressure on the dollar. And the other reason the economy's falling apart, which goes back, you know, there hasn't been a real wage increase in over 30 years in the United States. They pay workers about as much as they needed to get away with so they can kind of recreate themselves and come back to work. But they don't pay them enough to buy back what they produce. It's a classic crisis of overproduction. And now you have a recession, a deep recession. How long and how bad, we can only imagine. So you've got the crisis economically, and you've got the crisis in Iraq, and then overlaying all of that is the ecological crisis.
Shouldn't forget the war in Afghanistan, guys, which is going very badly, if you're the United States right now.
We'd like to follow up on a couple of the stories that we've covered over the last few months. As we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Sami Al-Aryan is on a hunger strike to protest the government's disavowing, essentially, of his plea bargain that said he did not have to cooperate further with the government. And as you may remember, the government actually subpoenaed Dr. Al-Aryan for the third time, an ostensible way to extend his prison sentence. He was due to be released in a couple of weeks. He's a diabetic. He is not being fed intravenously, and everyone involved in the case is extremely worried about his medical condition.
An established professor at a university in South Florida, they got him on one of these fake, let's terrorize people by calling them Muslim charges. He was acquitted. We interviewed his attorney on the show, and the attorneys actually read the Declaration of Independence to the jury, and that's how he was acquitted.
His daughter was on the show and been working with you, Heidi, to show the film about her father.
Yes. There will be a film screening called USA versus Al-Aryan. It will be held this week, this Thursday, the 27th of March, at 6:30 p.m. at NYU Law School. It's Vanderbilt Hall on the south side of Washington Square Park South, open to the public, and Lila Al-Aryan, his daughter, will be there to speak about the case.
I would really recommend this. I mean, Lila is great talking about what this case has done, not just to her father, but her entire family. And the film, I think, is a very important film about what you can only call U.S. barbarism.
This is like many of the other so-called terrorism cases, Lynn Stewart, and others, where the First Amendment is involved. And what we really have is, it's kind of an exception to the Fourth Amendment. I'd call it the Muslim exception, where people who speak out critical of this government's policy vis-a-vis Israel become the object of the government's targeting. Ashcroft held a press conference. The arrest of Dr. Al-Aryan was actually televised, just like Lynn Stewart's arrest was announced on David Letterman. So we have a pattern here of abusing the First Amendment.
Two stories we have followed here over the years is the U.S. torture program and the U.S. warrantless wiretapping program. There's been some recent developments on both fronts. With regard to the torture program, there was recent legislation put before President Bush, which he vetoed, and that legislation would have required the CIA and other agencies to only interrogate people according to the interrogation methods put in the Army Field Manual. In other words, the Army Field Manual has 19 different techniques. I don't agree with them all because there is one called isolation and another one called false flag, in which you pretend you're from some other country, which of course could lead you to think you might be tortured. But in any case, they're much more restrictive than what the CIA has been doing with water torture, sexual humiliation, stripping, hooding, the whole crowd of what we have referred to as Rumsfeld torture techniques. In any case, this legislation is voted by the Democratic House and the Democratic Senate. It goes before President Bush. Again, the legislation says the CIA must adhere to the Army Field Manual interrogation methods. President Bush vetoes the legislation, leaving the CIA free to continue water torture and the like. A number of interesting aspects of that veto, of course, continues us on the public program of torture. Secondly, Mr. John McCain, or Mr. supposedly tortured by the Vietnam McCain, actually voted against that legislation, saying that he didn't agree with it, that there were already enough laws in place to protect people from torture. So indicating his utter opportunism on this issue of torture, McCain basically says, I'm not going to outlaw the CIA from engaging in water torture. A second important aspect is that while this legislation was vetoed, Congress may not have the votes to actually override the veto in both houses. You know, the Senate's only controlled by the Democrats by really one vote. Even assuming they pick up some Republicans, they'll have a few more. But they do have enough votes to actually cut off funding. You don't have to allot money for these programs. Tomorrow they could say no monies allocated to the CIA shall be used for, you know, water torture, or just say no money's available for that. They don't need, that's not vetoed. That's just, they don't allot the money. But of course, our Democrat Congress, as much as they've moved slightly on this issue, have not moved forward enough to do that. So it was really a bad, bad last week with regard to the issue of the American program of torture. A second issue that we've been covering, as I said, was electronic surveillance. There's been disputes going on for months. As you recall, the president went outside the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and has been warrantlessly wiretapping American citizens, as well as reading all of their emails with special machines they put on at various telecoms to sort out all of our email. It's contrary to the law. The Congress, under the Republicans, gave him a six-month extension to continue a warrantless program, essentially, under the Protect America Act. That expired, and so right now the president should be thrown back on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the requirement for a warrant. Probably isn't, because he considers himself as commander-in-chief to do whatever he wants to do in the so-called war on terror. In any case, there's been a dispute going on. The House, to its credit, on some level, refused to buckle to the dispute and refused to give the telecoms, the telecommunication companies, immunity from their past illegal, warrantless wiretapping cooperation with the United States government. And that's where it stands right now. The House has said we're not giving immunity. The Senate says we want to give immunity. No bill has been put before the president. The president has said even if he gets a bill, if it doesn't contain immunity for the telecoms, he will veto any legislation. That doesn't mean that the House bill is so great. It still gives what's called a basket warrant, and the basket warrant still allows too much wiretapping in a warrantless way against American citizens.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've examined numerous cases involving overzealous prosecutions of Muslims suspected of terrorism. We take a look now at another case, that of Fahad Hashmi. Born in Karachi, he immigrated with his family to New York City over 20 years ago. A devout Muslim, Fahad established himself as an Islamic activist in his community, and by 2003 had enrolled in the London Metropolitan University to pursue a master's degree in international relations. In the summer of 2006, Fahad was jumped by United Kingdom police in London's Heathrow Airport. Then he was arrested for providing material support to Al-Qaeda. Essentially, the charges were for allowing an old acquaintance by the name of Junaid Babar to store rain gear in the closet of Fahad's London flat. It turns out that Junaid Babar was a paid government cooperator who has been used to testify against Muslims around the world. Nicknamed Supergrass by the British media, Babar was used by the government to testify against Omar Khayyam and several other Muslims in the so-called fertilizer case. Meanwhile, Fahad remains in prison. After being in Britain's most notorious Belmarsh prison, he is now housed under special administrative measures in the Manhattan House of Detention. Essentially, he remains under sensory deprivation with no contact with the outside world. He can't even see a newspaper. To talk about this case, we're delighted to have with us his father, Syed Anwar Hashmi, and his attorney, Sean Mayer. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
Many of our listeners are not familiar with the case of your son's arrest in England and his subsequent incarceration. Can you give us a few details about what happened when you first learned that he'd been arrested?
First, I learned on 6th of June 2006 that he was arrested at Heathrow Airport. We call from Heathrow. Subsequently, then we came to know that he was arrested by the FBI. It came to our door and informed us that my son is arrested at Heathrow Airport. Before that, I didn't know anything about it.
And where were you living at the time?
I was living in Queens, where I've been living more than two decades in the same apartment in Flushing, New York.
And your son had grown up in Queens
as
well?
Yes, my son grew up in Queens. He went to Brooklyn College. He has a degree in political science. And then he went to London, Metropolitan University, and had a degree in international relations with the subject of globalization and international politics.
Now, when the police called you, did they say why he had been arrested?
No, we called and said that he gave the telephone to my son, and he then said to us that they're arrested and get in touch with the attorney over there in England.
Was he incarcerated in England?
He was in England all the time. I mean, since the time he extradited to New York after almost a year.
Sean, how did you get involved in the case?
Well, the family contacted our law firm back when Fahad was initially arrested in England because they needed to secure counsel in England and they wanted to have counsel here in the United States that could coordinate what was going on in England with what we knew at that point was an indictment in the Southern District of New York.
The facts of this case to us are rather astounding. Essentially that Fahad had in his apartment a raincoat belonging to an individual who had ties to Al-Qaeda. But it's more than that. This individual, can you explain a little bit about who he was?
The allegations that we're being told, because a lot of this is going to be based potentially on secret evidence, but back in 2004, Fahad was a graduate student in London. And around February of March, an acquaintance of his who he'd known back from his days in the United States said, "Could I stay in your apartment for a few weeks? I'm coming from out of town, from overseas." That person stayed about 2 weeks and left. Over 2 years later, as Fahad is in the airport to go to Pakistan, he's arrested and basically informed at that point, after a brutal arrest, that he's being held for terrorism charges in the United States. And as we've been able to piece this back together, that individual who stayed with Fahad back in 2004 has become a cooperating witness with the U.S. government and has been used to testify in the fertilizer trial in England, about a year-long trial. He may be testifying in Canada. He might be brought here for this case, obviously. And his allegation to the government is that this person, this cooperating witness, kept a suitcase with raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks in Fahad's apartment. And then that person supposedly took it to South Waziristan, Pakistan, and hand-delivered it to the number three ranking member of Al-Qaeda. So putting aside whether you believe this person's story, the allegation is not that Fahad is a member of Al-Qaeda, not that he handed anything to Al-Qaeda, no money, no weapons, nothing, but merely that he supposedly knew that this person had the waterproof socks in his apartment and allowed him to do so.
Are they saying that he knew what one could use waterproof socks for? I go fly fishing and we use them. What's the matter with having waterproof socks?
Well, the way material support statute is drafted, if I cut off my fingernail clippings and I give it to someone I know is a member of Al-Qaeda, that is potentially material support. So the allegation from the government is they say that the cooperator informed Fahad that he was keeping those socks there and was going to give them to Al-Qaeda. So that knowledge, coupled with allowing your apartment to store those socks, is enough under the material support law.
So you have the word of this informer against the word of your client, and that's what goes to the jury.
Exactly.
You know, it seems to me that this is one of many trials that appear to me not just suspicious, but intended to scare people based on really no substance. Lynn Stewart's been on our show many times, and remember the allegation against her was conspiring to give material support to a terrorist. What was her material support? Issuing a press release. You know, these things seem to be so concocted. Is that a fair word to use about the allegations against your client?
Well, at this point, our investigation would lead me to the conclusion that you're making. But the trouble is that these statutes are so serious, and the ability to get a fair trial, unfortunately, is so difficult with the sensationalism of these charges, with the fact, you know, that these charges carry 70 years in federal prison if Fahad is convicted. And in federal time, it's basically a life sentence. He would potentially die in federal prison on this. So as concocted and as ridiculous as it sounds to an objective listener, this is a deadly serious case for our client.
No, I understand that. If you had to characterize your son in terms of politics, what were his political interests and how would you describe him politically?
You know, when he went to the Brooklyn College, he has a major political science. So the political science majors can tell you that he's interested in political studies, political. Whatever his views was, he's a religious person and everybody loves him. His activity, I can tell about more about it, that he's very social. As a matter of fact, I got a letter from blood donating thing that his blood is A group or whatever it is, so he can come. But at the time, he left already. And so
to be a blood donor, to give
blood. Blood donor, yeah. Things like that, that he has a sample. So you can imagine that he's a well-loved person and...
Had he ever spoken out politically to criticize U.S. policies?
My attorney will tell about it because this is the legal thing. I mean, so.
Oh, right. Now, we should explain to our listeners, Fahad is under special administrative measures, which means essentially, and Sean can explain a little more, that he's under the strictest conditions. His communication is cut off pretty much from the outside world. Sean, can you elaborate?
Sure. This is exactly as what happened in the Lynn Stewart case. Fahad is being held in solitary confinement. He's locked down at least...
What prison?
He's in MCC Manhattan, in federal detention in lower Manhattan.
Right near here, yeah.
And he's locked down minimum 23 hours a day. He's not allowed any recreation time in sunlight, no natural air. He's under orders not to communicate with anyone in the outside world except for the lawyers and his immediate family that are pre-cleared by the government. He has electronic monitoring in his cell and outside of his cell. So if he even tries to speak through his door to another inmate in that solitary confinement cell, he's subject to even more discipline. It's basically the idea of total sensory deprivation and social isolation as we see in Supermax. But this is pre-trial. Even under the most rigid conservative view of our legal system, he's presumed innocent, yet he's being treated like this. So there are certain things that just can't be relayed because of these administrative measures that we've tried to object, but the judge is upholding.
Are you even allowed to tell us if you've visited him?
I'm his attorney. Yeah. I have the right to visit him. I'm visiting him.
Can you tell us what his mental shape is in?
I can't comment directly on that, but what I can say is for anyone who has a client under these circumstances where it's total isolation, that you're locked in this room for days and days on end, cut off from virtually the outside world. He can't even get a New York Times, okay? Any news is cut off and to the discretion of the Bureau of Prisons. any lawyer with a client in that position is extremely concerned about not only their psychological well-being, but their emotional health and how that then impacts their physical health. All of it's interrelated, so it's a very concerning situation.
Tell us what sensory deprivation can do to the human psyche.
You know, we're biological beings, and we rely on outside stimuli to grow and to be healthy. And you cut that off. I mean, I'm not an expert by any means in the psychology and the physiology, but if you have a person who's in a small confined room with white walls and a door that's shut and there's no noise coming in, you've cut off a key biological function of that person. And there's no way that a person isn't detrimentally affected by that over time.
Isn't it the law that people have a right to bail so they can prepare their own defense against a criminal charge? Isn't it compromising somebody almost totally to lock them up with sensory deprivation so that they can't even defend themselves?
Absolutely. We think so, and we raise that in court. Our motions have been denied. Unfortunately, there are judges in this country that are upholding these methods of treating people pre-trial. And not only pre-trial is it wrong, but this is, again, what's going on in Supermax. This is cruel and unusual punishment. This should be a violation of the Eighth Amendment also. And this is the battle that lawyers are having across the country with this.
It also violates international norms of, arguably, one could say this is torture.
And it's being litigated, actually, in Europe for people that are that the United States is trying to extradite to this country. Challenges are being raised in European courts that this is a violation of human rights standards, the SAMs, the sensory deprivation, and it is being litigated right now.
Tell us, Sean, when is the trial set for?
Right now it's set for the end of July of this year.
How long has your client been under these onerous conditions?
The day that he was brought to New York, which was in May of 2007, he was immediately placed in solitary confinement. We had a detention hearing shortly after that. We raised how he has no prior criminal record whatsoever. None. He had been locked up in Belmarsh Prison for a year in England. There was no allegation that there was any untoward or illegal behavior on his behalf, no discipline problems whatsoever. There was a member of the community who was willing to put up $500,000 collateral for his bail. We were willing to do GPS monitoring, home detention, whatever, for someone who is presumed innocent and with the type of charges, and it was flatly denied. And he was placed in with no amount of bail, basically detained until trial. And then at the end of October of 2007, we received word that the acting attorney general issued the SAMs against Fahad, and then they up the ante even more against him.
He's 28 years old.
Yes.
Has a brother?
Yeah, one brother.
This must be devastating on the family.
I tell you, the whole family, we had an American dream. It turned into a nightmare. We are going through our family peace is shattered economically, mentally. We are broken. There is no word I can explain what we are going through. And the listener will understand that, and I can ask them to pray for my family, for Mia and my family. That's all I can say.
For our listeners who have just joined us, we're speaking with Saeed Anwar Hashmi, the father of the imprisoned Fahad Hashmi, and his attorney, Sean Mayer. Sean, is there a website that people can go to if our listeners want to give you some aid and support? Are there trial dates they can come to? What can our listeners do to help?
Yes, there are supporters who have started websites. There's one, www.freefahad.com. That's FreeFahad.com. I'm told that website is keeping a running list of upcoming events. There will be a court date on April 2nd at 2 p.m. in federal court in Lower Manhattan.
Can people come to that?
Absolutely. It's a public court date.
Will there be a protest outside or anything?
At this point,
maybe the National Lawyers Guild can help arrange something like this.
Sean, we'll link our site, lawanddisorder.org, with the freefahad.org site. Can you give us that date again, when the hearing's going to be, and what judge, so people know where to come?
It's April 2nd at 2 p.m. with Judge Preska. the Southern District of New York.
And which building, which courthouse is that?
500 Pearl Street, United States District Court.
The next event will be the 29th of March. Is that at Columbia University?
Yes. There will be a conference at Columbia University. There will be a panel discussion. Michael Ratner for the Center for Constitutional
Our
Rights.
Our own co-host here.
Will be there. Aziz Huq, who is Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, who has been litigating a number of these terrorism cases and is involved in one before the United States Supreme Court. Professor Aga Saeed, myself, Maurice Saleh Khan will be the moderator.
There's an event, I understand, at Brooklyn Law School?
Brooklyn College on
Brooklyn College.
May 5th.
May 5th. We'll post information about that on our website. What I find startling about this case, though, is in some of the other cases, people might have spoken out or been more visible, say, on their campuses or in their community. This case doesn't sound like that.
Fahad was definitely involved in different activities to raise awareness about Islam. He was involved in protests against U.S. foreign policy back when he was in Brooklyn College a number of years ago. You know, then he went to London, and, you know, 2 years later, from 2004 to 2006, nothing.
So it makes one wonder how far back they've been watching individuals who do speak out or protest.
And I think that's a crucial thing for people to understand, that there is a huge First Amendment component to this case, because it's anticipated that the government is going to try to say that because Fahad, you know, spoke out against U.S. foreign policy, that he's involved in a Muslim group that does that, that that somehow shows motivation to commit a crime of terrorism. And that is absolutely wrong, and that's not what we should stand for in this country in a courtroom, because that is such a slippery slope before we start saying any organization shows that you're have a propensity to commit a crime.
In fact, many of the cases we talk about on this program do have First Amendment implications. Samuel Aryan, the Chicago cases, yet another constitutional right that we seem to be losing.
Right, particularly when any group that Fahad was in was completely legal, above board. And the United States government has a website. It's called OFAC, O-F-A-C, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And they list every group that's supposedly a terrorist group designated by the U.S. government. No group that Fahad has ever been in is ever listed on this website. So then to go back and say, well, you know, any groups he was in weren't terrorist groups, but somehow it shows that he was involved in Al-Qaeda is ridiculous. But it's the atmosphere that we have to battle at that point, because people hear Muslim, they hear allegation Al-Qaeda, and unfortunately many people just shut down at that point.
This has really been an honor for us to have you both in the studio. We're going to try to help mobilize our listeners, and I know the National Lawyers Guild will help do what we can to get people in the street. As always, awareness of cases like this, I think, are the first step in moving toward justice, hopefully. But we remain positive, and we'll send our good wishes and thoughts.
I really thank you very much that you have given us a chance to explain our feeling, personal feeling. I hope that the listener will pray for my family so that we can get peace one day.
Saeed, Sean, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Recently, at the annual Left Forum in New York City, a panel was held
titled Torture and the Decline of the American Empire. Speaking at the panel was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Alfred McCoy, who's written extensively on the topic of torture, from the University of Wisconsin, Marnia Lazreg, from the Hunter College and Graduate Center, also author of a book on torture, and the panel was chaired by our own Michael Stephen Smith, New York City author and attorney. Let's have a listen now to Michael Ratner's talk.
Thank you, Michael. As Michael said, I'm with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we began the first of the Guantanamo cases in January of 2002, when they were, to put it mildly, extremely unpopular to take on. Death threats and all that. We continue to be the coordinators of all the Guantanamo litigation, as well as now, sadly, representing one of the people charged with 9/11 conspiracy before a military commission, a man who has been brutally tortured, unfortunately. His name is Mohammed Al-Qahtani. Like some of our other clients, most of our other clients, tortured badly. Today I woke up and, as usual, I looked at, although I don't always read it, the New York Times, and particularly outrageous day in the Times. I don't know if you saw the Week in Review, but they have a nice five-year piece on the Iraq War, whose fifth anniversary is coming up. It's by John Burns, and it's basically a justification of the war. And then they have eight or nine commentators to talk about it in the op-ed section. Not one person who was against the war, as far as I can see. Two people from the American Enterprise Institute. Really a nasty day in the Times. But because it's about torture, I wanted to pick up and see what they said about that. So I went to the Burns article on Iraq, and he talks about the mistakes that were made in Iraq. And he says the absence of a plan, at least any the Pentagon intended to implement, the fact that the disbanding of the Iraqi army, all these systemic issues that the U.S., had they only fought it right, would have been able to, quote, win it. After he talks about systemic issues, he talks about what he says are non-systemic issues, or what I'm saying are not. And he says, beyond these, the systemic issues, there were the instances, and listen carefully, the instances when America's intentions were betrayed by its troops in personal ways with the abuse and torture of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. So let's think about that. First, if the only time you ever see them using the term torture is when it's talking about individuals carrying out acts, not when it's the government or the Bush administration using enhanced interrogation techniques. It's only when it's individuals doing it attributed to them. America's intentions. This is a betrayal of Americans' intentions to torture, when in fact it was part and parcel of American practice from the very top to set up a systematic torture regime or program. From the very top, from Bush, from Cheney, from Addington, from Rumsfeld, all the way right down into Abu Ghraib. Betrayed by its troops who were given instructions about how to torture, the Rumsfeld techniques, its troops who General Miller, after using the techniques at Guantanamo, is sent to Abu Ghraib to gitmoize Abu Ghraib and use those techniques. That's what our Times is thinking about in terms of torture. It's so completely outrageous that at this point, after you hear from Al McCoy and after you hear from Marnia, that they're still talking about this as a few bad apples is quite, quite remarkable to me. You know, at the Center, we've done a lot of work representing survivors of torture, people who haven't survived torture. In fact, my first case, the first day I walked into the Center, was the day after the slaughter of prisoners up at Attica Prison in the Attica Prison Rebellion in 1971. I was sent up there and saw hundreds, really, of inmates who had been tortured brutally after the retaking of the prison. And so immediately after you begin very early to understand that torture may have very, very little to do with interrogation and much more to do with other issues, some of which this panel will address. Despite my long experience with torture, I've actually learned a lot in recent times. I've learned a lot from Al McCoy's book on the history of torture, on the Kubark Manual, on Vietnam and My Lai, and today is the 40th anniversary of the My Lai massacre, 40th anniversary of a torture program carried out in Vietnam, the Phoenix program that tortured tens of thousands of human beings. My Lai was all part, not a bad apple situation, again, part of what that war was. So I've learned a great deal from Al. I've learned a lot from Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. You know, I always see these slogans that say stop torture, end torture. And they're slogans, that's what they are, because they're slogans that are taken out of context. If you think of torture as either an abstraction or just an individual act, or just an act of torture even by a government, and don't see that torture is a tool or an implement in either an economic war or a real war or a war of terror by the place carrying out torture, you're never going to be able to stop torture because it comes out of a context. It isn't like some people just decide to torture. They decide, it's decided because, for example, in Iraq, that you're in an occupation and the people, many of the people, are against the occupation, and how are you going to get them to not oppose you? You're going to torture them. The other thing I learned, you know, I considered myself for years to be a civil libertarian, and people should have civil rights, and civil rights against torture, civil rights to protest, all kinds of civil rights. And I thought about it always really from the society's point of view, but also from a personal point of view. And what Marnia says in the book is, when you give up civil liberties or civil rights as they've been taken away from us in this society right now, you're surrendering the means by which we actually have control over the state. Our control over the state is because they have to comply with fair trials that are civilized, they have to comply with laws about the integrity of human beings, they have to comply with laws about where you can be imprisoned, and when you take those away, you're really lifting the restraints that are against the state. And that's really what's going on now. By torture, by all of these types of violations of fundamental rights, we're lifting the restraints that are against the state. When I looked at these books and thought about my deepening understanding of what torture is, I'm just in the midst of reading a book by a client of the center's and a client of a lawyer that we got involved in the center. His name is Murat Kurnaz. He was a German resident, Turkish national, picked up, taken, and spent 5 years in Guantanamo, eventually freed. He wrote a book, which will be out soon here. It's called 5 Years of My Life, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo. And when you, from the opening page, it is torture, torture, torture. Stuff that, you know, you can't stand, from bags over your heads, to nudity, to sexual humiliation, to being hung up for 5 days, to electroshock. Really unrelenting, day after day after day. And was it about getting information? You know, I don't think so. He didn't have any information, for starters. But here's what he quotes, some of the things that were said to him during this period. "You're a terrorist," they shouted. "We're Americans. You're terrorists. We got you. We're strong. And we will give it to you." And they never ceased screaming that at him. "You f***ers," is what they then said to him. I mean, nothing about information, but much more about vengeance, about whatever terms you want to use psychologically, about what was going on in that interaction, but not about getting information. As I said, the center right now, post 9/11, has been doing Guantanamo, representing many, many victims of torture. One of them is a man named Majid Khan. He was one of the 14 who was kept at a secret CIA site. And he's represented at my office, not by me, but by two attorneys who have what's called high-level compartmentalized security clearance. And they can visit with him, but all their work on his case is done at a secret facility in Washington, and they can't even tell me what happened to Majid Khan. They've interviewed him at length, they know what happened to him, they cannot tell me. They filed legal papers, which I have in front of me, with the court to say, we want declared what happened to Majid Khan declared to be torture. And then the court looks at those papers, it gets the full set, and then it redacts the papers, and that's the set that I get. There's some interesting things about the set. One thing it says, it's titled, as I said, Majid Khan versus Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, because he's being held by the Secretary of Defense. They say in the papers, this is Gita Gutierrez and Wells Dixon. "Although the MCA does not provide further guidance," that's what Al referred to, the Military Commission Act, "concerning the standard to be used to define torture or impermissible coercion, military and federal court decisions have categorized many of the various methods of interrogation and coercion used against petitioner as torture or impermissible coercion." Then you can see they blank out, you know, pages of what they describe. But they didn't blank out the footnote, which is the most interesting thing. The footnote is to this line, that many of the methods of coercion used against petitioner as torture or impermissible coercion have been defined as torture. And the footnote cites two U.S. cases.
United States v. Lee, affirming conviction for water torture perpetrated against criminal defendants by a county sheriff and two deputies. And then United States v. Chinsaku Yuki, Manila Military Commission convened by Commanding General Philippines using water torture against individuals in custody. Now, what's also interesting about that, that's against Philippines. Of course, the U.S. routinely used water torture in the Philippines as well. So that's the case of Majid Khan. As I said, there's Mohammed al-Qahtani's torture. He's the man who they have the Rumsfeld log strapped in the chair, intravenously fed bags of liquid, so he forced to urinate in the chair, naked on the floor, pinned down, straddled by women, officers, all kinds of tortures, which is actually in a log that you can actually get online. And then my first introduction to torture was the Tipton guys, who were three English people, who I interviewed in February, March in England in 2004, before the Abu Ghraib photos, and they described what Al has already talked about, the entire chain of Rumsfeld techniques, from stripping, hooding, dogs, taking away the Koran, the whole business. As I said, they want the world to know that we are a country of torture. I gave you one instance when I came in on the media and what's happened with media and pundits and the Dershowitzes of the world and the justification and the debate about torture. I mean, it's really, it's not just a little sad. It's outrageous and brutal and barbaric. We had a judge recently in our Makar Arar case. That was the man who was sent to Syria, rendered to Syria, tortured there for 10 months and 10 days. We had a judge actually write an opinion saying, you may not be able to torture people to get evidence to use in a court, but there's no Supreme Court case that's yet said you cannot torture someone for purposes of stopping terrorism. It's a federal court judge. So the media reaction and the pundit reaction, if you want to call it that, or the expert, has been really incredibly depressing to me. And it's they stay away from the word torture when they talk about it because they don't want to admit they're in a country of torture. As I said, they use words like enhanced interrogation techniques, harsh interrogation techniques, coercive techniques, and only when they personalize it to an individual who might have done something that's not Rumsfeld, do they say that person may have engaged in torture. I don't know if you all followed the recent issue on whether we were going to apply the Army Field Manual techniques of interrogation to the CIA. The Army Field Manual has 19 techniques of interrogation, all of which I by no means agree with, such as isolation and some other ones, or false flag when you pretend you're from another country. You know, the guy comes in and says, I'm from some country that routinely used torture. That to me is torture. But assuming I don't agree with all of them, the Army Field Manual is a step up. It's in many ways, I guess, from what the CIA is doing. So the legislation that was about to go through is called the Intelligence Authorization Act of 2008. And it was voted on in a relatively close vote in the Senate, I think 56 to 40-something.
51-45.
McCain voted, interestingly, and it's important, McCain voted against applying the field manual to the CIA, even though he's Mr. Anti-Torture, supposedly, but there's many bad stories we can tell about Mr. Anti-Torture. He votes against it. It goes to Bush. Bush vetoes it. And in his veto, here's what he said. This is, again, it was going to try and restrict the CIA from issues like water torture, sexual humiliation, stripping, dogs. Bush calls them specialized interrogation procedures. Another place in his veto message, he calls them alternative procedures. And then he says they're valuable tools in the war on terror, and that we've uncovered plots. And of course, you see almost nothing in the media how there's no evidence that they've uncovered any plots. They've not put any of them forward. If you read carefully, you'll find that they didn't actually uncover very much. If anything, Rockefeller, who was on the Senate Intelligence Committee, no great shakes as a Democrat on that committee, but he himself said, look, I've seen all the classified material. They didn't uncover anything. So again, even the excuse that so-called specialized interrogation procedures somehow work to uncover plots is complete BS, just that. And then, of course, you see the media coverage, of the veto. Here's the headline of the New York Times. Bush's veto of bill on CIA tactics affirms his legacy. Okay, so they're already calling torture tactics in the headline and not saying CIA torture techniques affirms his legacy. And then the lead paragraph, it's by a reporter named Stephen Myers. It says, President Bush on Saturday further cemented his legacy of fighting for strong executive powers, using his veto to shut down a congressional effort to limit the Central Intelligence Agency's latitude to subject terrorism suspects to, quote, harsh interrogation techniques. Look at what this is loaded with. First, it's not about torture. It's about strong executive powers. And it's not about torture. It's about harsh interrogation techniques. So there it is. Again, the Times completely pulling punches on what really happened here. What really happened is Bush basically kept his legacy of a torture program and a torture nation alive. And as I said, McCain at the low point on this one. And, you know, in thinking about that, you have to think, you know, is it all going to be a new tomorrow when we get new candidates in there? Or new presidents, whether it's McCain, that you can just, we can put him over there already. So then we're with Obama and Clinton. And yeah, they'll stand there in front of you and they'll say, you know, I'm against torture. But will they actually be against torture to the extent they get it out root and branch from this government and this country and these secret sites? I doubt it very, very much. I just don't think that is on the agenda. That would be looking almost as torture as a slogan and not in part and parcel of what this country is really about. So let me just say a word about Congress in that. You know, Congress sits there and say, well, we're not veto-proof, we've got to get a bigger majority in the House and the Senate, and then we can override it or we'll have a Democrat in there. But you know, Congress isn't left with simply passing a piece of legislation that the president can veto. Tomorrow, Congress could simply say, with veto-proof, we're just not going to allot money to the CIA to run secret sites, period. Just not put that in the budget. There's no veto of that. The money is simply not there. We're not going to put money in the budget to run Guantanamo. We're not going to put money in the budget to take away habeas from people. Everybody who you have in custody has to have habeas. So it's all BS by Congress that somehow they're worried about a veto. In some way, it's a show. They're passing this legislation, which, oh yeah, it's a little struggle to get it through. Bush vetoes it, and then they say, oh, Bush vetoed it. We can't do any more about that. I'm going to just talk about two quick things in a couple of minutes. One is what's going on with the six that have been charged with the military commission at Guantanamo. And it's relevant to torture because what the statute says right now for trying them, and I don't think they should be tried in any way except in a federal court, in any way with any less rights than you get in a federal court. What the statute said is you can't use evidence from torture, but you can use coerced evidence. Now, if you're the government, what are you thinking? Well, they haven't defined anything they've done to anybody as torture. So that means everything. Someone who's waterboarded, the 200 hours of tapes they had of Abu Zubaydah, all that stuff can come in because that's not torture according to them. So we are going to be seeing, if they ever get these trials going, and I'm not convinced they ever will, we're going to be seeing people try based on evidence that clearly came from torture. As a lawyer, we try and think about sometimes what can we do about this, and we've tried a lot. We've brought a dozen civil cases with other organizations around the country, from the ACLU to Human Rights First to other places, to try and sue various people for damages. So far, we've lost every case. We still have appeal in the Makar Arar case. That's the guy who was sent to Syria for torture. We've lost because either it's state secrets, the government says we can't disclose any of this, it's a state secret, we won't tell you, or we lose sometimes because it's considered within the scope of the authority of the person doing the torture that it was expected, and therefore the person is immune from the lawsuit because it was in their authority to do it. Remarkable that you would lose them that way, but we've lost them that way. So that's the civil cases. The criminal cases, the only ones you brought are the so-called bad apple cases. You know, the guys, the low-level guys at Abu Ghraib. You're not seeing, you know, people up the chain of command. The highest person actually disciplined up the chain of command was Janet Karpinski, of course. You know, the only woman in charge of, the Brigadier General in charge of the prisoner at Abu Ghraib, who, according to her, and I think very believably, knew nothing about what was going on in that particular wing. So the criminal cases are dead in the water here in the U.S., even probably with a Democratic government, because we're not getting the Democrats to even push for a serious hearing on the torture program or on impeachment or anything else. Then if we look at the criminal cases that we brought criminal cases overseas. We brought a case in Germany under universal jurisdiction, which is the idea that that a torturer is an enemy of all humankind and can be brought to justice wherever found. We brought them in Germany, we brought them in France, and we're working on one in Spain. We have so far not won any of those cases. They're on various appeals. I think those will actually have some efficacy going forward. I want to remind you of what Louise Arbour, who's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who's resigning in June. She's a Canadian lawyer who said recently about water torture. She said waterboarding is torture, and people who engage in it should be prosecuted under universal jurisdiction. Clearest message you could make about going after U.S. officials. And let me just say, when you read any of these books or writings by some people who are in the administration, the biggest concern they have is universal jurisdiction for their crimes, and they're not going to be able to go and visit Europe anymore because they might be prosecuted, and they're worried here as well. So it's not nothing, it's actually something substantial. Beyond that, and I just want to close on this, I mean, there's all kinds of actions all the time, from March 19th on the war, to witness against torture, the Catholic worker people who are doing great work around stopping torture. But to the extent you think about torture as an abuse, as an irregularity, as something outside of what this government is doing as a general matter, whether you call it an imperialist matter, hegemony, or decline of empire, as Marnia will talk about, you can't beat it if you're just talking about it as a slogan and don't get to really why this country has a torture program going on. Thank you.
That was our own Michael Ratner speaking at the Left Forum on the panel Torture and the Decline of the American Empire. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.